You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Archaeology Podcast. What are we? The CRM Archaeology Podcast.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, this is Stephen from Calgary. Welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Joining me today is Doug in Scotland. Is that right? Scotland?
Yep, that's where I'm at. Hi, everyone.
And our special guest, Bill Otter?
Otter?
I don't know how to pronounce your last name. Otter. Okay, I couldn't tell if you still had the...
just the full throated thing. Yeah,
Octor. Go full German, right on. Chris Webster cannot be joining us; he's at a conference, and I have no idea where Bill is. Sonia also could not be here, so I was given the reins of this show at the last second, basically yesterday, and was kind of hard pressed to come up with a topic on such short notice. So I contacted Bill and brought him on, and we kind of have a concept show for you. Part of this is coming from this past week. Bill has been tweeting a lot on basically he's starting to play a role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons. And so what we've done is for our show notes, we came up with a random encounter table, and we'll be rolling dice and picking short topics from a list and just kind of chatting about them. It's a grand experiment, and we'll see how all that goes. So, Bill, do you want to talk a little bit about yourself?
I'm Bill Ochter. I'm an archaeologist based in sort of the Mid-Atlantic, based out of Baltimore, Maryland, and I'm in the CRM field, and I do a lot of work on regulatory stuff, primarily associated with like wireless projects and things like that. But I'm really active, or try to be active, on social media through at ArchaeoThoughts. And there is sort of like an opportunity, a place for me to play around with different ideas. The idea of the thoughts behind it is that I was a philosophy minor in undergrad. And so the idea of thoughts always come in the world of thoughts always play a role. So like this week, I've got an itch to get back into the world of Dungeons and Dragons, something I played in high school during the, I guess now it's called second edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons era. But now I think it's up to fifth edition, and it's a different world, it's a different game, but I enjoy the idea of sort of collaborative storytelling. And I see that plays a lot of parallels between that and anthropology and archaeology, where you sort of gather people, you gather information, and through all that, you create stories of the past. So that's sort of how I tie all those things together.
So not just the treasure hunting bit.
No. It's not just treasure hunting. You could play... I mean, there are places for that, of course. I mean, you can play your video games like your Lara Crofts and your Uncharted's. And you could do that in Dungeons & Dragons, too. But no. I mean, I guess it's too much of the archaeologist in me. It's about the context.
Sure. Well, and this is, I didn't even think about it until you're just talking right now. But this all kind of plays into the whole archaeo-gaming thing.
Oh, yeah, very much so. I mean, I'm online following other... folks like Daniel Kwang, Curiosity and Focus, who are much deeper into sort of the world of tabletop gaming. And there's following a bunch of other folks who are, active archaeologists who are using this as a disciplinary tool to sort of further help explain, create sort of public archaeology outreaches by using the gaming format to sort of explore a past world. There's a lot of really cool things going on in sort of the tabletop archaeo gaming world. And I'm just more of a fan at this point than anything else.
Sure. Well, and like you say, it really does seem to really have picked up. I started I used to role play a lot, like starting with the basic set, the old red box, and when I was in junior high, and then like in high school, you know, moved to Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, AD&D, in first edition, and then second edition as an undergrad, and then started branching out and doing other things like Cyberpunk 2020 in grad school and stuff like that. And then the early aughts kind of rolled their own. It's really time consuming, right? You know, so like if you're trying to do other stuff, it's really hard to keep up. But there does definitely seem to be a huge resurgence in the whole tabletop role-playing stuff, which I think is pretty interesting.
For those of us not quite familiar, do you guys mind explaining a little bit more about archaeogaming and like in a general overview? Not just like tabletop, or if you don't mind, like explain that to me. Much appreciated.
Okay. My view, I mean, this is really sort of the lay person. I'm the one who sort of reads the content that the others are creating. But the way I see archaeogaming is, I see it as sort of multiple levels. Like one level is using the tools of the archaeologist to explore created content, created world. So you would say play a video game, which had an immersive open world, and you would use the tools of archaeology, data collection and analysis, to sort of explore that world. But I also see another side, sort of archaeogaming as sort of almost the exact opposite, where you use the tools of a game, whether it's a video game or role-playing game, to sort of help further explore actual spaces. So you could use a virtual world to explore a Roman villa, reconstructed, or you could use tabletop role-playing game to recreate battles, and so forth like that. So that's you know, for me on the outside, that's sort of how I look at it. I'm sure there's much more technical definitions of it, but as a receiver of that, of the work that they're doing, that's how I look at it.
Cool. That answered my question.
Okay. So what we've done for our show notes is we have a bunch of short possible topics. We probably won't hit on all of them, but the idea is that it's structured like a random encounter table. The good old adventurer's standby for role-playing games. And so Bill is going to roll some percentile dice, and we will pick the corresponding topic and then just kind of go around the virtual table here and talk about that topic for as long as we please. How's that sound, guys?
Okay. Let me go ahead and roll the first die.
Right on.
So we have a 9, which brings up Dragon's Horde.
Okay. Dragon's Horde. Let's talk about curation. Yeah. So I don't necessarily have a good way to start off on this, except that, you know, what do you feel about the state of curation now? You know, there are a lot of issues with space, lack of space, and the fact that, you know, curation is often perceived as a dragon's horde. Like, you have to get past the dragon to get at it. So, Bill, I'm going to toss it straight back at you. So why don't you give it a start and toss your thoughts in?
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, from the CRM perspective, curation is always sort of that elusive end piece. And depending on your project, whether you're working for a public entity or you're working for a private firm, curation can either be an extremely diligent and important part of your project, or the absolute afterthought that is scrambled once all money has drained out of a project. And that sort of inconsistency I see is definitely a problem. There's a talk, and there's good statutes out there from state SHPOs and so forth regarding, you know, if you're going to do a project, you have to have these are the curation standards if you're going to dig and so forth. There's even states I know like Arizona will ask you specifically, you want to make sure before they issue you permits, how much money do you have so they can determine whether or not you'll have money to carry through the entire project, including curation. But I see that as once again, sort of the general problem of CRM. It's inconsistent because it's 50 states plus territories in the District of Columbia. So there's 50 some odd rules and different organizations and different companies consider those things more importantly. I've been on projects where we've delivered a final report, a phase three closing report, but curation hadn't been finished yet. And then all of a sudden we were out of money and we're scrambling to try to just get it down to the repositories to get things going. So that inconsistency I see as one of the major problems.
Sure. And, beyond just the 50 states, right? Like we have all the provinces and territories up here in Canada. But some of the problems, not just the inconsistencies, but like, you know, what happens to all this stuff? You know, what do we do with it? It's kind of like the end game, right? Like, you know, we get the stuff. The last thing we do is we stick it in storage. And then if we're lucky, maybe a grad student will look at the stuff, but how much of it's actually getting used or, what happens to it? What's the end life?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about that. I mean, from the curators I've actually talked to, they're I was just sort of addressing sort of my concern from my seat, but I also have, talked to other curators where their concern is one, they don't have this is a sheer amount of space, especially in the United States where we collect a lot. There's no real general idea of purging of collection. So if we're going to collect nails, we got a bunch of nails. And sometimes there's some smart methods, and other times we're going to send all those nails up to the collections. And you're also right about the idea of use. I mean, I've heard something recently, a discussion about the idea that, maybe we dig too much. We are all about, creating a new kind. I think it was a conversation I was overhearing concerning like grad students and things like that we dig too much, that it's all about creating the new shiny thing so that you can write your PhD and your dissertations and publish the book and publish the article. And that's easier to do with something brand new and shiny rather than, say, a reanalysis of another collection and so forth like that. So, we're doing that. And then if you want to keep going, there's the whole digital issue of having the resources to digitize these collections so that they are more accessible to more people. I mean, if you want to do, say, a meta-analysis of all pottery in the Chesapeake, that is now beginning to happen, but it's slow and it requires money. And you really can't do those things reasonably without sort of digitally, archiving these things where it's not just physical locations. You have to take that data, upload it, create it in searchable content that talks to each other. This is also, now I'm getting a rambling point, but this is where different states, once again, we're back to the problem of the different states because, a collection in say Maryland will not necessarily talk to a collection in Ohio. And the idea, I mean, I know there's works, right now, because we're doing all this quick, I can't think of anybody's acronyms, and I'm sure we can add them later. But I know there are efforts being made for digital archaeology to sort of create those sort of cross-state ideas of research so we can actually bring about the larger analysis.
Sure. Well, and in the most recent advances in archaeological practice, the most recent issue is all about synthesis. That's like the big hurdle, right? Like, that's the next step. That's the end goal of all these small things is that we bring them all together and synthesize them into larger studies. But there are a lot of, logistical and just, practical hurdles to jump if we're going to be able to do all that sort of stuff. Something you mentioned earlier, I want to kind of go back and touch on the notions that we're digging too much. Something that was kind of put forward to me this past week, just as a conversation, wasn't even like about this, was the notion that, you know, it's expected that grad students go out and dig a site because that's how it's basically their practicum. That's how they learn to run an excavation. I don't know that that's, you know, that kind of rubs up against, you know, the idea that like we're digging too much. Like if you know, a grad project is designed to be like a practical skill-based sort of thing, that it makes sense that it should kind of at least parallel what we do for CRM. On the other hand, that ends up with, you know, massive more, you know, collections.
Yeah, I mean, to sort of split this up into two sort of, I guess, different separate areas is one, I'm not sure how much control we have in CRM about how much we dig. Obviously, most clients would prefer we wouldn't because excavation is quite expensive and that saves them money. But in that sense, you know, the vast majority of archaeology is done in a sort of commercial sense. So I'm not sure we can really do much to reduce our digging. And then to flip it around on the academic sort of side, we'd actually discussed this a couple of years ago, like not the CRM, but I've discussed it with some other archaeologists, that we actually thought it was kind of a, you know, going through the training of a field school, it's kind of actually a really horrible thing to have your field school as your training aspect on live archaeology, as it were. One, as a student, it can be quite nerve-wracking to sort of have that thing of, ooh, am I doing this right? Am I missing things? And then for very complex sites, you know, you really do, digging and excavation is a skill, and there's things that you pick up over the years where you're able to see the soil change, and you know, you can see where part of it's collapsed and backfilled, and you can make sense of that stuff that you would never be able to do as an undergraduate. And so we were always talking about how you should actually just make a giant sand pit place where you could actually train people. But in a sense, you could make different colored sand and, you know, use a post hole digger, dig it out, throw in a different color of sand and have someone, you know, excavate it that way. So they actually weren't practicing on live archaeology. And you know, it'd get rid of some of those issues of, you know, when you're at a field school, if you find something important, all of a sudden, you know, whoever the supervisors are, or even the person in charge of the dig comes over and takes it away from you, and you actually don't get that chance to dig it, because it is important. So, you know, I think if you're talking about an academic way, there's probably better ways to do it than have people practice on live archaeology. But then, you know, part of the attraction for students is to actually go to sort of exotic locations and dig, you know, the actual archaeology. So, you know, it's a flip thing, but I think there would be ways about, you know, reducing that in academia. CRM, I don't know. I'm sure every client would love to, but there are certain cases I don't think we could get around it.
Yeah, no, I mean, your idea of the test pits just made me think of an analogy of the idea of like in medical school, you know, a surgeon, to become a surgeon, needs to cut bodies. And so, you know, the idea of a cadaver, which is sort of a deceased person. So it's a situation where you're digging, but it's not really, you're not really doing harm. But I also know there's more virtual reality is becoming a bigger thing. But, you know, these are all things down the road. The idea of a test pit would require planning, time, and money. You know, so a department would have to commit to those types of things. So there's always a balance. Sometimes it's cheaper. I mean, in the world of CRM, I know this, it's cheaper just sometimes just to give some people some shovels and send them out in the field rather than some of the, you know, non-obtrusive remote sensing methods we have to detect sites and analyze them. And so forth like that. But it's definitely an interesting dilemma.
Sure. And, you know, coming from you know, I used to work in a military setting, and like the military uses all sorts of different simulations, you know, as for training, right? You know, I mean, you want it to be as realistic as possible, but clearly they're not going out and fighting. In some cases, you're compartmentalizing skills and focusing on, you know, individual skill sets, and then you're bringing it all together and all that sort of thing. So I've kind of always wondered, why are we doing like real excavation for field school rather than, you know, some sort of simulated skills learning process? But we are out of time for this segment, so we will go to a break and come back and probably pick a new random encounter. We'll be back in a few.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast. I can't remember the name of our own show. Jeez. We are going through our random encounter table and coming up with topics and giving a brief discussion about those topics. Bill Ochler is manning the dice, so if you want to pick the next topic.
Okay, here we go for the next topic. We have a 10. I'm rolling high today. And that would be sunset.
Sunset. What's sunset? I believe sunset's kind of the end game. Most of our, you know, like legal documents are memorandum of understanding and programmatic agreements and all of these things have, you know, what we call sunset clauses. The end of things is not necessarily something we tend to think about. Like, you know, like when we're designing new products, we're not necessarily thinking about the end of life. Like, how do we remove these things short of like disposing of it in a landfill or something like that, or which eventually gets found by us and put in the curational facility. So I guess we're kind of taking these topics backwards. You know, so I guess there's two ways we could take this topic. One is, how do we as archaeologists deal with the idea of preservation, of preserving things in place? The other topic is, how do we get out? But that, you know, when you do a business plan, you tend to have some sort of like a plan of like, how do you close up your business? How do you get out of your business? Do you sell it? Do you, you know, just wind it down? That's part of a business plan. So I will throw this on you guys. You know, you can take either one of those and run with it. What do you think? What's our end game? What's our sunset?
Silence. Geez.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. I guess I'll jump in and take that sort of that last one. I mean, just riffing off of your, like, you know, how do you get out and sort of selling off your company and stuff like that. I mean, it's a bit complicated in that most people in CRM are not going to actually have that option. I'd say that the majority of people are looking at a sort of normal retirement, normal, and no one can see this because it's all audio, but I'm doing, you know, air quotes right now. In the sense, I think most people's plans are just hoping they have either some sort of 401k or retirement of some sort, or Social Security or the equivalent of that. So in the UK, that's national insurance. Basically, you know, a state provided pension. I don't know. Do you guys have different plans to leave? I think most people aren't in the sort of, in the view of passing off their company and their works. Most people don't have a company.
I would think probably for most people, leaving archaeology is probably going to be something outside of their control, whether it's the end of a project or an end of a term with a company or a change in the regulatory climate, which reduces the need for that. A lot of this is out of our control. But it did make me think of the idea that for a lot of, especially in a CRM world, a lot of us are more of like it's project based. So it's not realistically like like other types of careers where, you know, we are working from project to project to project, so that in some ways we start work, we do work, and our work is finished hundreds of times over the course of our career. It just so happens, kind of like life, one time when it ends, it's for real this time. And sometimes we can plan for it and sometimes we can't. So I'm starting to think of, like, you know, how do construction managers, because this is sort of within a CRM world, a sort of a parallel track in terms of they get projects, they have to manage those projects. There's lots of moving pieces, but eventually those projects are done. The building is built. We have finished excavating the site. We've delivered the final report and sent the artifacts to collections. That is when the building is nice and shiny and pretty, but we walk away and we're not involved in the actual use of it afterwards. So it is an interesting dilemma, but I think it's not necessarily unique to the world of archaeology in terms of, like, archaeologists as career professionals. Other people who work project by project, contract by contract, sort of all have this sort of problem. It's the gig economy.
Yeah. But there is a certain point where, you know, like you say, you know, we go out there and we do it, and then we do another project, and then we do another project. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we get older, right? Like, that eventually there's going to be a point where, you know, even if we wanted to, you know, maybe there's a point where we can't physically do it anymore. Maybe there's a point where, like, you're kind of forced out. How do we, you know, like, how do you, I guess the point is, like, how do we plan for that sort of thing? Like, you know, shouldn't we have some sort of exit strategy, knowing that there eventually at some point, and maybe it's going to be this year, maybe it's going to be 20 years from now, that is essentially at some point, by our choice or not by our choice, you know, we're going to have to get out of the game.
Well, since we're doing this sort of off the cuff, the only thing I can really lean back on is sort of my own experience. So sure. About 7 years ago, I sort of started getting into the CRM, telecommunications, especially. So I'm doing a lot of shovel tests. I'm digging a lot. But I knew, you know, I got into archaeology sort of late. I got into archaeology in my late 30s. So by the time 40 hit, the pains sort of began. So I knew this wasn't going to cut it. I couldn't dig holes for the rest of my life. So that was one of the driving forces behind going to grad school. And when I went to grad school, I chose history as for my master's rather than anthropology, because it would sort of give me another avenue to sort of stay within this world of CRM, because I'm one of the ones who think of the three-field CRM of archaeology, architectural history, and history as being all part of CRM. So it gives me avenues to sort of stay in the office and do that, or do the a small architectural survey. I can't do full ones, but I can do tiny ones. Get more involved in things like project management, where I'm the manager who's subbing out work to archaeologists who are going out in the field and doing the work. Or I'm more involved in the NEPA process, where I'm also looking at natural resources and putting together the final sort of category exclusion documentation needed for telecommunications work. So I began putting out feelers in different directions, so that I would have other alternatives. One, it's just a good career move. If you're flexible and you have a diverse skill set, If one thing ends, you can then jump, leap to something else. But also from a practical point of view, we were talking about the aches and pains, and my shoulder started to hurt, and I could feel the thing in my knee, and you know, all those little creeping pains that we all get over the years.
Sure.
So yeah, I think the real key is to you need to be diversified. I mean, we don't have in CRM, you don't have the luxury of being a single topic specialist. You have to be flexible because each project's different, each employer's different.
Yeah, and actually, I think it's a good topic to be discussing because I actually know several archaeologists who are trying to get out but actually haven't figured out how to do that. And you know, they're not, they're in the 30s and 40s or maybe pushing 50, but they're not actually. Archaeology is not what they want to do anymore, and they want to get out, but they actually are kind of stuck, basically, in archaeology jobs because they haven't actually figured a way out. I do wonder if there would be room in archaeology to have a course or a discussion or a paper or a workshop or a, you know, maybe even a full podcast that we devote to how does one plan to leave you know, even just switch careers and not necessarily at the end of their career when, you know, your knees are giving out and you're being sort of pushed out. But what if people, you know, instead of a push, what if it's more of a pull? What if they want to go change to something else? I, off the top of my head, I can't think of any sort of guidance or even a presentation. Like I couldn't think of like a YouTube video to send someone to. I couldn't think of a blog post. A podcast, I don't know, maybe you guys have seen something, but I can't think of a single resource that we provide for people on how to, you know, sort of move your way out of archaeology if that's the way you want to go.
No, I can't think of anything.
I can't think of anything either. It makes me think of sort of the grad school problem of the professor who's going to convince you that you're going to go tenure track when there are no tenure track positions. It's a sort of the same idea, you know, archaeologists like to talk about the continuation of archaeology, and we don't have this discussion of like, it's not going to be for everyone. It's not going to be forever. So what are the other paths? So no, that's something I think is much needed.
Yeah. That might be something to follow up on later, but we're kind of out of time for this topic. Shall we move on to the next one?
Okay, let's see what the dice give us this time. We have a 5, which is sequestered monks.
Yeah, this one's going to be pretty similar to the Dragon's Hoard, I think. The original question, because I actually have like a translation sheet here when I was just kind of writing down topics. Published materials are, you know, like the academic publishing institution, it's largely inaccessible to a lot of us in CRM. You know, there are ways of getting around it. You can ask the authors, you can, you know, maybe if you're lucky, there's a local university and you can have a short like citizen checkout for those types of things, you know, but generally, you know, the way that we're brought up in the academy is that you basically, if you're doing research on a topic, you look at everything that was written about that topic or as much as you can. But that's, you know, becomes like that, you know, hard to do from a cost perspective or, you know, even a time perspective for CRM. So along those lines, you know, if there's an academic library, you know, a body of published material for given topics and we can't access it, you know, what do we do? Does it actually exist? Do we ignore it? What do we do?
It doesn't exist. I take a somewhat controversial take on this because I also help run a project, Open Access Archaeology, which is the idea that basically, I think, Stephen, you've touched on this and articulated the problem really well, is people write stuff and they put it into journals and they assume that's published. And then they'll come back and they'll say things like, oh, well, you know, it's such a high level that even if we made it free, the public wouldn't be able to understand it. So why does it matter? Everyone who matters accesses it. But, you know, depending on the country, 2/3 to 90% of all archaeologists work outside of academia and don't have access to a library with sort of online access or even hard copy or anything like that to most of the resources. You know, you're sort of taught in school that you should always cite everyone's research and give them credit and stuff. But I think it gives a sort of perverse incentive, because I've read papers where people have cited stuff and I can tell that they've cited the abstract and never actually read the paper because it's behind a paywall. And so, you know, having access to that paper, I can be like, no, that's not at all what that paper said. But I think it creates bad science. So, there's a big push for everyone to always cite all the relevant literature. But if no one can read it, have we even published it? Or are we just basically glorified looters? So in the sense of, what we do to separate ourselves from looters is we say it's not for personal gain, even though we're being paid for it. And we say we record the stuff so that other people can use the information. But recording in itself, I don't think is actually worth, if you don't make it available, you've recorded it in a sense of it's somewhere, but you haven't published it. You haven't made it available to the wider public or even other archaeologists. So in a sense, you're basically a looter. You've dug up, whatever it is, you've destroyed the context. And if no one accesses it, what was the point? Though I have pretty extreme views on this, so maybe you guys are a little more mild-mannered.
No, I mean, what you brought up made me think of something that I always sort of think about while I'm out there digging holes and writing reports and things like that, is like, how much am I just a technician, just a sort of like glorified, skilled professional who provides a service? It's a report that allows someone to move the next step in the regulatory process. And how much am I an actual scientist who's actually, or historian who's creating information to sort of help the general knowledge of both scientific and our historical understanding of the past? And that is definitely like, you want to talk about something that creeps on me and makes me sweat at night about the profession is, I have doubts sometimes about, are we actually doing any good, or are we just a hired shovel to move through a process because of things like our reports on the CRM side? They go into state repositories, and some cases never get. I'm thinking, because I spend a lot of time in the world of telecommunications, there are certain states where we will file sort of technical short form reports, which are smaller than a phase one report. And those don't even get entered into the library of the SHPO office, so that other professionals don't have access to the work we did. Now there are other states that are better than that, and I've seen where they'll record our stuff. I'm going to side tangent now, but there's a problem where, say, you're working on a tower site, and this is the third time they've decided to build something there and something's come up. In certain states, you will conduct archaeology on that same place three different times without any knowledge of those who preceded you on there. But I see this as translating out to exactly the problem you're talking about. Because if we don't have access to the other works that other people have done, sometimes we're going to try to recreate those things and reinvent the wheel. Where someone else has probably done as good a job, or if not a better job, at that. And we can then spend our times doing what science should be doing, and that's standing on the shoulders of the past to sort of move us forward, rather than being in sort of a cycle of just recreating the same past over and over again.
Sure. And to go back to what you were talking about, like, what are we, what's our role in all this? I kind of have like two different mental models, and it's kind of like the insider and the outsider perspectives that, what we are in, or the way that we kind of conceive of ourselves, are more like physicians. We're not necessarily doing research, but we're going out there, we're looking at symptoms, we're diagnosing things, and then maybe depending on what comes back, you know, we'll see like a research opportunity, you know, as kind of a side thing. But really what the clients think of us, we are just really slow utility locators. You know, all they really want to know is, you know, can I put my project there or do I need to move it? You know, where can I dig? You know, what can I do? You know, what will you guys let us do based on what's already there? And that's exactly the attitude that we have when we're dealing with utility locators. It's like, can I dig here? Because I really want to dig here. And that is, you know, if you have like in your mind, like you want to be do research and stuff like that, that's kind of, or it could be, I suppose, demoralizing. That, you know, really it's like, you know, we just go out there and we provide a service. Anyway, it is time for the next break. We will start up for the third segment with a whole new topic.
Hey there, podcast listeners. I'm the Archaeology Podcast Network computer and server system, and I'm here to tell you about our newest supporter, WildNote. I know databases and computers, of course, and I know a thing or two about data security. WildNote is an Apple and Android-based digital field recording system that will help you produce quality data that are born digital. You can be sure that your data will be secure in the WildNote system as you collect it, review it, and export it as PDFs, spreadsheet files, or whatever you need. So, check out the 30-day free trial at www.wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your 30-day free trial. Now back to my ones and zeros. Hashtag binary humor.
Welcome back. We are randomly selecting a bunch of short topics and briefly discussing each one of them. Bill, do you want to roll the dice and see what we get for the next one?
Okie dokie. Let me go ahead and roll the dice. I've realized I've not been putting a role-playing flair on any of this stuff yet. So let's see what this orb of enchantment will tell us next. All right. Through the eyes of the enchantment, I am seeing a shadowy figure of what may be a geomancer.
The geomancer. Spatial data. Let's talk about spatial data. You know, we're out there now, you know, like more and more, we're incorporating GIS and GPS and increasing the accuracy of what we're doing. How does that play in with, you know, the maps of past work or stuff like that? So basically, you know, what are you guys doing for spatial data? How are you preserving it? How are you working with it? How are you creating it? What are you doing for workflows? I'm going to toss this straight to Bill, so you don't get a lot of time to think.
Well, thank you for that. But
yeah, no worries.
But luckily for me, once again, because I play mostly in the world of telecommunications, my actual interaction with geospatial information is actually very limited. It's typically because my sites are 100 by 100 foot squares with maybe a 20 foot wide by 300 foot access road. So your spatial information is actually very tiny and so forth. So a lot of it is sort of just creating general maps for both the client and regulators to sort of see. So, you know, you got your Google Earths, you can do your different layers of both the satellite views and the terrain maps to sort of get an idea. Actually, where I spend most of my time this type of data is sort of incorporating historic maps and historic aerials into a project area. I like the tools that you can use in both like Google Earth, and I'm beginning to sort of get my head around QGIS, but with, you know, where you can like put in plugins and I can, you know, geo-reference quad maps from 1890 and sort of get a general feel for where my site is. It helps. What it really helps for me is it's a time-saving tool, geospatial information. Instead of trying to hunt for maps and then trying to reconcile where they are in space compared to what I have, I can pull up single source information, put in my coordinates, and then see 100, 150 years worth of maps sort of roughly geo-referenced. Thankfully, my work is a little more forgiving, so roughly it is sort of good enough. So that I can see, was there a road there that isn't there anymore? Did someone mark a settlement that wasn't present when I was out there in the field? And it sort of gives me those tools to sort of broaden the conversation, because what I do is very compact. So you need to say a lot in a very short amount of time. So I have loved the idea that I can use these sort of geo-reference tools to tell stories that I wouldn't have bothered looking at historic maps 10 years ago in the same way, because it would have taken days of work to do that, where now I can spend an hour and tell a whole historic aerial map narrative about a single place with that. So that's sort of where I see I got a cop out on that.
Well, I would think that you also have, you know, and this is kind of squeezing it into the whole spatial realm, but, you know, dealing with things like visual analysis. I mean, visual impact, I presume, is still a big thing for towers. I mean, back in the 90s, you know, I never really did this, but there were a lot of like the balloon studies, right, where you put a balloon up and then drive around to all the historic bars and see if you could see it from, you know, the bar. And, you know, to gauge visual impact.
Oh, you're right. You're right about that.
Yeah.
The visual, you made me think of it. Okay, that's the other side of it, I guess. Viewshed analysis, balloon test, visual area potential effect analysis. Actually, you're getting on my topic for next weekend's Mid-Atlantic Archaeology Conference, which may come out. It'll be the weekend of St. Patrick's Day, which is going to be after this has been published. So check out Archaeo Thoughts on Twitter, and hopefully I'll have my poster up there by then. But no, this is a very
cool.
Yes, that is a very also a sort of a spatial analysis. It's extremely important, and especially with something like that, where knowing it's a good tool, because knowing if something is visible is just one, it's probably the first step of your overall analysis. Then you go through your whole step of, does it alter what makes that place significant, which is a whole different analysis. But your first step is the visual. Is it going to be visible from that place? Is definitely your first question or first answer.
Sure. You know, and you know, given that you've worked in the private sector a lot, when I think about like management, I think in terms of like spatial databases and maintaining records of, you know, like, you know, basically the past work. So you can reference it and maybe get a little bit of that synthesis going and stuff like that. And you realize that this is more like, you know, tying into what SHPO's and state archaeologists and, you know, provincial archaeologists, you know, tend to do it as like land managers. But I would think that being able to tie into databases would be a kind of a useful thing.
Definitely would be, or definitely is.
Doug, you got any input on this? Help us deal with the geomancer?
Yeah. Well, I guess I can just go with my most recent experiences. Pretty pumped about the new release of QGIS, QGIS 3. So that's quite, well, it's been almost 2 years since they've done a new version of QGIS. They sort of froze development and put everything into the next version. So that's a really big step up. And for those who are, you know, listening, maybe not familiar, QGIS is a software platform to do GIS. It's the, there's a couple of open source ones, but I'd say it's probably the biggest open source one, the most popular. So a lot of archaeologists tend to use it because, well, it's free. So you don't have to spend a small fortune on things like ArcGIS. Pretty pumped about that. And then I guess my other sort of what I'm working on now that involves geodata is I'm involved in this project over here in the UK to create a platform for research frameworks. So research frameworks are essentially you get together everyone in the room, you know, the good and the great about a certain topic, like, I don't know, Neolithic or, you know, lithics or pottery or something like that. And you ask, okay, so what's the information we know? And what are the questions, the big questions we should be asking for the next, you know, 5-10 years? And sometimes those questions are used by CRM, commercial archaeologists, to drive the research questions for, you know, investigations and things like that. So we're building this digital platform to sort of handle that interaction for people to put that those research frameworks up. And of course, a big part of archaeology is geodata. So, you know, where was this site and, you know, what's its relation to? And then also, you know, just even the research framework. So different regions will have their own research framework that's specific to that. So Scotland will have its own one. Actually, I'll have a bunch, so like the Southeast, the Southwest. Argyll and Bute has its own one. And then, you know, it gets that. So right now I'm in the fun sort of aspect of trying to build tools that people can use to query questions about research by geographic region and aspects like that, and maybe go deeper into sites and stuff. So that's my sort of experience right now with geodata or geography or general spatial data, however you want to call it.
Oh, cool. Time's up for that one. So let's see what our final encounter is. Bill?
All righty. So the orb seems to have one more mystery to give us. By which I'm going to re-roll that because it's the same mystery we just talked about. Ooh. Now this is an appropriate N1. Actually, I don't know how you spelled it out, but there's a monster lurking.
Uh-oh.
It is the Gorgon.
I knew we were going to get that one. This one, we actually kind of talked about a little bit. Because it is... again, it's kind of the permanence thing that, so maybe we want to skip it.
Well, I mean, I can go into it. I mean, I think before we started recording, we were talking about, sort of my recent, history. And, this might be actually the point to sort of talk about that.
Sure.
So this week, much like a lot of archaeologists will find out, well, not find out, but happen to them over the course of their career. This week I was laid off from my current position. So now I find myself as a sort of mid-career archaeologist who is now back on the job hunt. And sort of tied into everything we've been talking about today. It's a slightly different point of view. It's not like a field technician, even though I might have to do some field technician work in the short term to make things match. But this career search is definitely more of the formal career search. It's the filling out resumes and doing the LinkedIn profiles and getting some networking done with other contacts to try to find openings and potentials, or maybe there's an insight with somebody you know at another company. You know, so it's both within private sector and public sector and even nonprofits, sort of exploring what are the avenues, given my skill set, that I can next find someplace that's open. Also, slightly different than other times in one's career, I find myself sort of tied geographically. You know, I'm mid-career now. I've made roots, a house, and a family, and so forth. So packing up and going to the next open project in the Great Basin isn't really an option for me because I'm here on the East Coast. So those are all sort of the dilemmas and things that are thrown out there right now for me as I'm sort of stepping into this world where, and it's been, I've been sort of fortunate. I've not been laid off from a position since 2002. I've had to quit a few, But this is sort of the first time in a long time that I've sort of been thrusted unexpectedly back onto the job market.
Sure. By the time anybody's listening to this, I'm going to be on a short-term layoff as well. So, you know, I have expectations that I'm going to be going back to my job once spring starts thawing out a little bit more and the work picks up. But, you know, I'm kind of very aware of these topics that you're talking about, because I'm in my mid-40s and, you know, yeah, it's you know, I can't just, you know, there's been some pretty nice job postings from, you know, down in the southern U.S. And it's like, oh, that sounds like a cool job, but, you know, I can't move down there for these. I'm pretty much here. And, you know, what are the options? You know, I'm somewhat familiar with, you know, the various firms that, you know, work in this area and you know, are these places that I want to work for? And if I do work for them, you know, what are, you know, future possibilities? You know, what are they going to turn into as far as advancement or something like that? That, you know, these are, you know, considerations. Or to go back to, you know, the sunset thing, you know, is this the signal that it's time to get out? And if so, you know, how do you even do that? Doug?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a interesting crossroads as well. Being based in Scotland, but not being a British citizen, I have to be on visas. And so I've managed to string that out for a really long time. And I have my current employer who sponsors me. But essentially that means is my ability to stay in this country and my wife's ability to stay is based on me being able to hold this job. Part of it is still funded for another, half of it's funded for another 2 years. But the other half of it is basically, we were supposed to have heard at the end of February if we were getting funding, and that's now been pushed back to like the 15th of March, and probably will get pushed back again, but our funding runs out at the end of March. If that funding runs out, my monthly pay goes below the threshold. I lose my visa and basically get kicked out of the country. It'll be a bit interesting because it's been almost 9 years since I've been working in the U.S. So going back there would basically mean starting over again. So I don't have BLM permits or anything like that. I mean, I have enough days and stuff. I could probably quite quickly pick up some in New Mexico. I'm assuming that there's not like a time limit on that, and it has. I'd have to check on that. But basically, if that happened, my career, as it were, would pretty much, for the most part, end, and I'd have to start over from scratch. At which point, it's one of those things of, do I really want to go back to, you know, very bottom field tech wages, you know, not having permanent contracts or anything like that, you know, sometimes weekly, week to week, or is that where I decide, you know, archaeology is not for me and I move out? So yeah, kind of actually in a fairly similar position as you guys, though a bit different.
This really is turning into a monster of a topic.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, we're not doing very well against the Gorgon this time. do you guys have any other thoughts on this topic?
Well, I mean, some of the thoughts are sort of the basic thoughts that sort of anyone in their career should think about in preparation for these types of inevitabilities. It's the creating a savings so that you have a few months of buffer after a layoff, because while depending on the season, it might be easier or not to do a short-term tech position, something like a project manager or a PI is going to take much longer. Those positions don't come up as often. When they do, the vetting process, the interview, the hiring process, it takes much longer to do. If you're going to look into sort of governmental positions, that process takes even longer than that. So there's sort of like short, medium, and long-term strategies you sort of have to have with that. Your short-term is, you know, covering your, you know, making sure you can cover your bills for the time that you're unemployed. The medium term is maybe looking for a position that will help fill a gap, maybe take on a project or two, while the long goal is to get back into something with a little more permanence to that. But you kind of need those plans. I mean, and you guys have talked about this plenty of times regarding field technicians and sort of the seasonal ups and downs and the preparations needed for that. You get that never stops. That's why I guess one of the lessons from here is that thing that never stops. You always have to be prepared for some sort of inevitable unexpected turbulence to your job and career, because the Gorgon can come out from anywhere.
Well, I think that about does it for time. So let's wrap that up and do our goodbyes. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned in the show are in the show notes for this podcast, as well as the hopefully a photo of the random encounters table. And these can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at www.arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Also, send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for archaeologists everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks particularly for Bill Ochter for joining us at the last second. And thanks also to the listeners for tuning in. We'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And wait.
Bye.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to arcpodnet.com/members for more info.